Easter focuses on two things. If you're a child, you might think that those two things are bunnies and Easter eggs. But that is not the story of the Bible. The story of Easter, as we have it in the Bible, focuses on two very different things, one of which not at all pleasant: the death of Jesus of Nazareth. And of course, it is Good Friday that focuses on that particular aspect. But Good Friday cannot be disassociated from Easter Sunday, the day on which we celebrate the second focal point of Easter, the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, the fact that he came alive again. Someone phoned me during the week and was asking me some questions about Easter and asked me whether I celebrated Good Friday. And how is it that someone could celebrate the death of another? It's a very good question to ask, especially when we consider the kind of death that we're celebrating. A death that was marked by cruelty. The Roman crucifixion of criminals has generally been regarded as the worst form of execution that mankind has ever invented. It was humiliating. It was excruciatingly painful. It was lengthy. And of course, ultimately, it was something despised. How can we celebrate the death of a person? And the death of a person by means of Roman crucifixion? Well, the reason, of course, we celebrate the death of Jesus is because it was a voluntary death that he chose to undergo in the place of others. In other words, it wasn't a death that he had to endure. It was a death he chose to endure. And furthermore, it wasn't a death that he deserved, but that he died in the place of others who deserved such a death. Why wouldn't the people who had been spared death celebrate the death of their substitute? Wouldn't that be a great thing to do? Well, of course it is. And that is why we celebrate Good Friday. It was a good day. Not because of the cruelty of the death, but because of what that death accomplished. Now, in our studies in the Gospel of John, we've already considered the death of Jesus, and we're moving on now in our studies to consider other aspects that followed on from the death of Jesus. But we cannot consider them divorced from that fact. They are tied up with it. And as we focus this morning on the burial of Jesus and then his resurrection, we must see that John's description of the burial of Jesus is intended to emphasize the fact that he had actually died. John takes great care to record certain details of Jesus' burial. He tells us, for example, of a man called Joseph of Arimathea, who we're told was a disciple of Jesus, but he was a secret disciple. Now, John has referred to these secret disciples earlier in this gospel. He's told us that they were secret disciples because many of the leaders of the Jews were so hostile towards Jesus that these men, and presumably women as well, were afraid to openly acknowledge that they thought well of Jesus and liked his teaching. So Joseph was one of these. Isn't it interesting that at the point where Jesus is hanging dead on a cross, he chooses to make known the fact that he's a disciple of Jesus? Nowhere are we told what motivated him to do so. You see, at this point, the idea of resurrection is far from the minds of any of his disciples, whether they were secret disciples or open disciples. None of them are thinking in those terms. They're thinking about the tragedy of what has unfolded. For them, the man that they had looked up to as the one who would deliver them from Roman oppression lies dead at the hands of the Romans. It seems interesting to me that Joseph chooses this moment to align himself with a man executed for sedition. But he does, and he goes to Pilate, and he asks permission from Pilate that he might have the body of Jesus so that he can give him a proper burial. Well, perhaps there's the hint as to what's motivating Joseph. Though he would view the execution of Jesus as a calamity, he still holds him in high regard, and he can't bear to think of this great teacher being thrown into an unmarked common grave outside the city of Jerusalem, which is what would have happened to those executed by crucifixion. They were given no honoured burial. No proper procedures would have been allowed to have been followed. They had relinquished all rights to that when they had broken the law and been found guilty and sentenced to this cruel death. But Joseph wants to honour Jesus. We're told in the other Gospels that he was a wealthy leader of the Jews. In fact, he owned the tomb into which Jesus would be placed that night. Coming to Pilate, Pilate gives him permission for Jesus to be taken down from the cross and buried ceremoniously in a tomb. That's interesting in and of itself because, as I've already indicated, normally they would be unceremoniously pulled down from the cross and thrown into a common grave. It is perhaps another indication that Pilate truly believed in Jesus' innocence. Another jibe at the religious leaders of Jerusalem, perhaps, with whom no love was lost between Pilate and the Sadducees. He allows Joseph of Arimathea to take Jesus down from the cross and to bury him. And then we encounter another man from Jesus' past. Nicodemus is the leader of the Jews who came one night to Jesus to ask some questions about his teachings and was told that he needed to be born again if he was to enter the kingdom of God. He too was a secret follower of Jesus. He had come at night before for fear of the Jews. But now he also comes openly. He also is a man of wealth. And he brings with him a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds, that's more than 30 kilos weight. This was indeed a burial fit for a king. And again, we have an indication of perhaps what motivated these two men to more openly show their allegiance to Jesus. They had such a huge regard for this man. They were willing to expend vast sums of money to give him a royal burial. And so he's carried to a tomb. He has his body wrapped in these cloths, linen cloths that would have been bound around him together with those spices, not to preserve the body, as was the practice of the Egyptians, but rather these aromatic spices were intended to some degree to cover the stench of decomposition that inevitably would take place in that climate within a very short period of time. Another indication that these men had no concept that Jesus would rise from the dead. Another significant detail is mentioned, that he was placed into a tomb in which no one had yet been laid. Most of these tombs were for families, for generations. And so as each member of the family passed away, their body was laid in this tomb. And for a period of about a year, it would lay on a kind of a carved shelf within the tomb until the flesh had rotted away and only the bones were left. And then they would be gathered up and put in another part of that tomb. It's into this kind of setting that Jesus is placed. But it's a new tomb. It's only recently been carved out of the rock. There's no one else lying there. Now, that's an important detail. It's important because there was no confusion among the disciples as to how many bodies were in the tomb. They weren't mistaken when they came to the tomb in a couple of days' time and discovered the stone rolled away and Jesus' body wasn't there. It isn't that they had miscounted, because there'd been no one else in the tomb before Jesus' body had been laid there. There was absolutely no doubt at all in the minds of these disciples a few hours hence that a body that had been placed there was no longer there. Now, why does John take such great pains to record these details for us? Well, the death of Jesus is in view. Not the crucifixion as such, not the manner of death, not the humiliation of his death, but the certainty of his death. John wants his readers, he wants us, to be sure that Jesus had died. We can't go to the tomb. No one knows exactly where the tomb is. It's highly improbable that it's the actual site to which tourists are taken today. We can't see for ourselves. But we can listen to the eyewitness account of one who had seen. Why is it important that we should be certain that Jesus had died? There are those who claim that Jesus didn't actually die, that he swooned on the cross and that his body was taken down, and as it lay in the coolness of this tomb, he was revived, but not resurrected. He had never actually died, they claim. Well, it's rather fanciful to think that of someone who had been crucified, for whom Pilate had given strict instructions, and from whom Pilate had received an assurance of the centurion who oversaw the crucifixion that Jesus was in fact dead. It's generally accepted that when it came to matters of death, the Romans were experts, and they would have made no mistake over passing the judgment that this man was indeed dead. He had been so cruelly beaten that he was not even able to carry a piece of wood up a hill to the place of his execution. A spear had been thrust into his side, and out had flowed water and blood. The exact significance of that is debated by scholars and experts, but it is generally accepted that it is understood to be a proof of the death of Jesus. Now, why is all of this so important? It's important because it is by the death of Jesus that salvation is provided to sinful humanity. To use a theological expression, it is the death of Jesus that propitiates sin. Propitiation means the turning away of God's anger. The Bible presents Jesus as absorbing the wrath of God himself, so that the proper targets of God's wrath are spared. Paul reminds us in his letter to the church in Rome, the wages of sin is death. And he says to the church in Corinth that God made Jesus to be sin, though he knew no sin. And again he says, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Not for himself, not because of his own sin. No, he was sinless, he was without sin. But God accepted his sacrifice in our behalf. The wages of sin were paid to him, and he died on the cross. And it's absolutely essential that Jesus died on the cross, or sin hasn't been dealt with. The wages have not been paid. And we are still in our sin. If Jesus had not died, there would be no salvation from the wrath of God. Now, this is the central message of the Bible. From the first book to the closing book of the Bible, the theme is salvation from the wrath of God, justly deserved for rebellion against him. The death of Jesus is essential in the provision of this salvation. And so John presents the certainty of the death of Jesus by describing his funeral, his burial. The fact that Pilate had given permission provides certainty of his death. The fact that he was buried with his body wrapped in spices indicates the certainty of his death. As his disciples bound his body there, if there had been any hint of life left in him, they would have discerned it at that point. The fact that he was in an empty tomb with no one else there, and so no mistake could be made, provides certainty for his death. But the account goes on to tell us that on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. She called others, Peter and John, and they went. And they went into the tomb and discovered that the tomb was empty. Jesus rose again. Jesus came back to life. Well, you say that's not exactly what is said here. True. The description is certainly a very matter-of-fact catalogue of the events that took place that morning as John provides them. Mary going, Peter going, John going, the discussion that they had, Mary's conclusion that someone had taken the body of the Lord away. None of that signifies resurrection from the dead, certainly. And it has to be acknowledged that the story that was circulating in Jerusalem within a few hours was that the disciples had stolen the body away. But it's evident from the eyewitness accounts that the disciples had no idea where the body was. We don't know where they've laid him. We don't know who's taken him. And if it had been the authorities who had done it, well, they could so easily have provided the body, couldn't they, to quash any rumours of a resurrection. But that never happened. No, the account that we have is so matter of fact that we must give it all seriousness. Even the discrepancies between John's account and the accounts of Matthew and Mark and Luke, each one of which is slightly different from the others, bears the testimony of authenticity, as different people recount their memory of the events of that particular occasion. They're not so different that they cannot be reconciled. And so Mary and Peter and John discover an empty tomb. Luke tells us in chapter 24 and verse 12 that Peter went away marveling, wondering at what had happened. What had happened? Sometime during that night, probably close to sunrise, given the fact that one of them records an earthquake taking place. At some point, within that tomb, with a stone rolled across it, a man who was dead opened his eyes. Somehow, he got out of those linen cloths. Were angels there to help him? You remember perhaps that when Jesus had called another dead man out of the tomb, Lazarus was still bound. And Jesus had to tell people to help him get out of those grave clothes. Did angels come? We know that angels were there. They spoke to Mary. Or perhaps, as some have suggested, the grave clothes as they lay there in that tomb indicated that Jesus had somehow miraculously risen out of them and left them in their place. Certainly we know that in the days that followed, he appeared miraculously into a room with a bolted door. Suddenly appearing where there was no one before. No, we don't understand exactly. We cannot understand the details. It would all be pure speculation. But what we do know is that Jesus rose to life again. That body that had lain lifeless in the tomb got up from that place and came out of that tomb and would be witnessed to by many in the days that followed. Now, this wasn't a stolen body by the disciples or anyone else. No one would have taken the trouble to unwrap all that linen cloth and 30 kilos of spices and taken it away to another place. Not a stolen body as Mary had assumed to begin with, but a resurrected life. Why is it so important? The empty tomb is important because it is Just one among a number of pieces of evidence demonstrating the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. And that resurrection of Jesus from the dead proves the acceptance of his sacrifice on the cross. I've already indicated that if Jesus hadn't died, there would be no salvation. But there's a further truth that we must understand. If Jesus hadn't risen from the dead, there would be no salvation. It would mean that Jesus, still dead, would still be paying the price of sin. We would have absolutely no confidence that God would accept us through faith in Jesus if he still lay buried in a tomb outside Jerusalem. Paul tells us that he was raised for our justification. Isn't that interesting? Not that he died for our justification, but that he was raised for our justification. Because it is his resurrection from the dead that proves that his life was a valid substitute for ours. And God, we're told by Peter, raised him up. Well, Peter went away wondering about all these things, pondering these things. But we're told that the other disciple, whom we understand to be John, the one who had reached the tomb first but went in second, he saw, and we're told he believed. What did he believe? Did he simply now believe the word of Mary, whom he had suspected before of just being in a hysterical state? Is that the reference of faith for him? Yes, she's right, the body isn't here anymore. Now, the words signify something far deeper than that. His belief was absolute. He saw that the tomb was empty. He saw that the burial clothes were laid there in their place. And he believed, though as yet he didn't understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. He saw and he believed, even though he didn't understand. He saw the evidence there in the tomb, and he was completely convinced that Jesus was no longer dead, but that Jesus was alive. But he didn't understand it. It didn't make any sense to him. And at this point in time, he wasn't able to match his eyewitness evidence of Jesus' resurrection with the predictions of the Old Testament that we ourselves have already considered in our readings from the book of Psalms. Yes, there was evidence, there was prediction. The death would not hold him, that his body would not see corruption, that he would rise again. Jesus himself has time and time again told his disciples that he would die and after 3 days he would rise again. Well, all of this has just gone over their heads, of course. And even at this point, John doesn't remember these things. He will remember them later. He saw and he believed, even though he didn't understand. And that, my friends, is what we are called to do. Though we may not see, we may not be able to enter into a tomb outside Jerusalem convinced that it was the burial chamber of Jesus and see that he's there no longer. Well, after 2,000 years, you wouldn't expect to see very much. No, we cannot see with our eyes. But we have the evidence of many eyewitness accounts in the Bible. And all the assaults that have been made against the reliability of these accounts have been judged ineffectual. We have the Bible and its explanation of these events, of the incredible consistency of the accounts, and the complete fulfillment of so many prophecies of the Old Testament. It's all there for us to examine and to see how it all ties together in the life of Jesus. We also have history and its testimony of thousands, of millions of people who have been willing to lay down their lives on the basis of this truth. Even today, people are dying because they believe that Jesus rose from the dead to save them from their sins. Now, you may not understand it all. You may have many, many questions in your minds. But are you willing to believe the account of the Bible and to explore further the implications of it? John saw, and he believed, and the Bible calls on you to do the same.